Gentlemen, let's get down to business.
It's time to live the money life with Chuck Jaffe.
I think you're shagadelic, baby. You're switched on. You're smashing.
Helping you invest, handle, manage, and protect your money.
You ain't all that in a bag of potato chips.
And now, here's Chuck Jaffe.
Chuck Jaffe.
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
Welcome to Money Life for March the 24th. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show. And I got a great show planned for you today. I want to take an extra minute here to talk about something fun, too. So let me rush through this. I'm excited. Can't you tell? We've got a great show planned. It starts with Tom Lydon in for the ETF of the week. After which, I'm taking one of your questions, and it's a question that pretty much affects every one of you. Because even if you didn't ask me the question, you probably own a fund and you're paying for the expenses that we're talking about. So I've got a question from an audience member that I think affects a lot of people. Hopefully I answer it well enough that you all will learn a little something. Then Bob Powell, my MarketWatch colleague, editor of Retirement Weekly, in to talk about the Employee Benefits Research Institute 2016 Retirement Confidence Survey, something I may be writing about this week as well. And then the Money Life Market Call. Roger Conrad from Conrad's Utility Investor will be talking utility stocks and closed-end funds. I offered Roger the ability to look at our list of closed-end funds too, just in case, because he really is an income guy, not just a utilities guy. And he came back with a closed-end fund as part of the mix as well. So that's kind of interesting. We'll get a take at that at the end of today's show. I'm Chuck Jaffe, senior columnist for MarketWatch, host of this show every weekday. You know all of this. So let me get to this thing that I wanted to talk about because I don't have infinite time here. My friend at MarketWatch, Barbara Kohlmeyer, wrote a fabulous piece yesterday that went up about Robert Kiyosaki. Not my favorite guy. Robert Kiyosaki is the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and whatever. And you can find some not so nice things. He did like an education thing. These days, I kind of wish I had written about Trump's education stuff, which I could have gone to and known that it was going to be stupid investment of the week. But I instead wrote about some Rich Dad stuff that was occurring right around the same time. I've never liked the Rich Dad, Poor Dad thing because I don't find a lot of veracity to it. There's a lot of things in there that have always bugged me. But he wrote a book in 2002, Robert Kiyosaki did. It became another one of his bestsellers called Rich Dad's Prophecy, in which he predicted that the worst stock market crash in history was going to occur in 2016. And now he's back and he was telling Barbara Kohlmeyer he expects that is what is indeed coming. Now, his logic back in 2002 was that the market was going to crash in 2016 as the first wave of baby boomers hit age 70 and a half and by law were required to take distributions from traditional individual retirement accounts. Yeah. Okay. The demographics. And he says that he still believes that demography is destiny. Now, he's not the only one who believes that demographics drive destiny. And I think demographics are very, very important on a lot of fronts. But this is a case of, let me try to make myself relevant again. Ooh, doesn't the market make you scary? Look what I was calling for 15 years ago. I just have a tough time with this one. I have a tough time with this one because if we wind up with a market crash, and you don't have any guests on this show who are regularly calling for one, if we wind up with a market crash, I don't think it's going to be the demographics that are the real reason. It might be issues with the Fed. It might be issues with the economy, with terrorism, with any number of other things. But I don't think you're going to go, oh, man, too much money came out. Because the truth is that while you're going to see money come out, most of that money is now invested in mutual funds. And it's not coming out and coming out of the economy. If anything, if you thought, oh, retirees are going to take that money and they're going to spend their required minimum distributions, if you thought that was going to happen, that would be good for the economy. But that's not what I believe is going to happen. I mean, I look at my parents or my in-laws, folks who I was talking to about their money, and they want to know what should I take my minimum required distribution out of, but then they want to know what should I reinvest the money in. In other words, they're pulling money because Uncle Sam says, you got to pull money. And Uncle Sam says that because they got to pay taxes. Fine, no problem. But they're not pulling that money going, okay, I'm going to spend it. This money's coming out of the market. Instead, they're turning right around and reinvesting. So the impact on the market may be a heck of a lot less than I think people are assuming when they lean heavily on the demographics, right? If you're looking at your retirement plan and you go, okay, I go back to my father, right? If my father was taking an annual distribution and he decided to take it out of one of the Fidelity funds and he took it out of, I don't know, Fidelity Growth and Income, and he then reinvested that money in another account, his taxable account, he was going to go put it into a taxable account fund, which was probably going to be something from Vanguard. So if he was buying, I don't know, Vanguard Strategic Equity, was it a direct wash? No. But even if you did that kind of move a million times over, the impact was pretty negligible. So as much as you can make a case that the market's going to have all sorts of problems, you can look at China and come up with some pretty scary scenarios. And as much as I don't think Robert Kiyosaki is in any way, shape, or form alone in his bearish view, I, you know, the next crash may be inevitable, but I don't think that it's the worst in history based on demography. I don't. And I think Kiyosaki, in giving the interviews, and his folks have talked about coming on the show. I've said we'd have him on the show, and then somehow he can never appear with me. I don't know why. But I think it's a question of like, hey, I haven't written a bestseller since 2002. Let me go off and do it. I don't know. I wouldn't let it scare me. Let's put it like that. All right. I had to get that off my chest. You know everything, I think, by now about the show. And if you don't, well, tune in tomorrow. And I promise I'll tell you then how to reach us, what to do on Twitter, all that other good stuff. Right now, we're going to get to the show. We've got a lot of stuff and I'm excited. It's Tom Lydon. It's me taking a question from one of our audience members, then Bob Powell, and then Roger Conrad. Oh, yeah, we're going to have some fun and we're going to kick things off with the ETF of the week when Money Life really gets rolling right after this message.
Looking for alternative ETF strategies? Direction provides separate and distinct audiences with flexible investment tools to manage risk and execute short-term strategies. For more information, go to directionshares.com.
It's ETF of the Week time, and that means Tom Lydon is in the house. Tom, of course, is the editor at ETF Trends. If you want more information, go to ETFtrends.com, not just to find out about the ETFs that we talk about on the show, but to get any information on the ETF space from soup to nuts. What's new, what's different, what's changing, they cover it all at ETFtrends.com. If you want more information, follow the site on Twitter at ETFtrends and follow Tom on Twitter at Tom Lydon. Tom, welcome back to Money Life.
Thanks, Chuck. It's great to be back.
Our ETF of the week is
the Vanguard REIT ETF, ticker symbol VNQ.
Okay, the Vanguard REIT ETF, VNQ. Is this a yield play? Is this an alternative investment play because it's not stocks, bonds, and cash? Is this something else?
I think it's a little bit of both, Chuck. There's an interesting story about REITs. Yes, with the fact that the Fed has come out and not hiked rates in March is a good thing for real estate, for sure. In fact, earlier in the year, the Fed proposed that they might hike rates as many as four times in 2016. Now consensus is maybe one to two times. So that's great for those that are looking to borrow to get into the real estate area, whether it be commercial or residential, number one. Number two, the yield's competitive. In this ETF, the yield's over 4%. Very competitive from an income standpoint. And as you say, alternative income strategies really are in vogue these days, and people need to consider them, especially as treasuries are probably more challenged during a rising rate environment than REITs might be. But I think the biggest news might be this. Recently, Standard & Poor's announced that in September, they're going to create a new real estate sector in its classification system. Now, for the average investor, that may not mean a lot. However, for institutional investors and advisors that are trying to stay properly allocated with conventional indexes, this could mean, according to J.P. Morgan, as much as $100 billion being shifted over towards this new sector. And $100 billion in REITs is a heck of a lot, which could really buoy from a demand standpoint. It's currently above its 200-day average, which I know you're going to ask. So that's another positive. And really, this is, from an allocation standpoint, something that investors might consider if they're looking for that alternative yield play, but also from a fundamental standpoint, not only is the REIT sector in a position where there's going to be greater demand, but just for the fact that S&P is creating this new sector could be very, very favorable for maintaining that demand, especially as we go into the fall.
You know, you talk about it being above the 200-day moving average. This is the kind of thing that you're really talking about making a permanent allocation to. I mean, it might be a 200-day moving average play, but if you go for something like this, this is really more about, do you want to have money allocated to real estate rather than do you want to be above the 200-day moving average, isn't it?
It's really for both. I think more and more investors these days are looking at their traditional allocation. Maybe they had actively managed mutual funds. And if you put your whole portfolio together and you go to Morningstar, for example, and if you find that you're 98% correlated with the S&P 500, but paying a huge expense ratio, you kind of ask yourself, why am I doing that? All I need to do is buy the S&P 500 with a 0.03% expense ratio or 6 basis points or something like that, and I can mirror that and save myself over 100 basis points a year in fees. But they're doing that and then taking it to the next level. I think many investors these days are saying, yeah, it's been a pretty good run-up since the lows of March in 2009, and saying, now as we look at markets today, not all markets are created equal. There might be some sectors that could actually do better than others, and REITs are one of them. So with that, if you're a buy-and-hold investor, you might consider shifting some of those areas that might be more interest rate, rising rate sensitive, and shift more towards a REIT allocation, number one. Or if you try to be tactical and you try to look for opportunities in the marketplace, here, not only from a technical standpoint, is this ETF just above its 200-day average, you're also getting a pretty good yield. But on top of that, the fundamentals about the S&P putting a new sector together, that might continue to drive funds and buoy this marketplace for the next 12 months.
How far above the 200-day moving average are we? And is it the kind of thing where if it gets there, you might say, maybe I actually change my mind?
Right now, we're 4% above the 200-day average. So it's a very, very comfortable area. We've had a spike coming off the low about 6 weeks ago. Very favorable trend in place right now. If you're a trend follower and you buy at this level, not a lot of downside risk, 4% if you end up planning on selling it at the 200-day average. But this might be the beginning of a new uptrend.
And I want to step in for one other thing here.
Sure.
Quickly, because we have talked about all the reasons why you'd want to own REITs. There is one thing that I know my audience has heard from some other guests on the show recently who have talked about REITs, which is the worries about certain types of REITs. And we should point out that when we're talking about the Vanguard REIT ETF, we are really talking about mostly diversified REITs, the big names. We're not talking about stuff that you ever would expect a blow up, which can happen periodically in the REIT world, but it happens with the non-traded goofy stuff, not the kinds of things somebody would see in this portfolio.
Exactly. There are not any wild plays here. Most of the big conventional names. And to top it off, the overall expense ratio in this ETF is 12 basis points.
One more reason to like the Vanguard REIT ETF. It's ticker symbol VNQ. It's the ETF of the week from Tom Lydon. Tom, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Chuck.
Tom Lydon is the editor at ETFtrends.com. Check out the site for more information. Follow them on Twitter at ETFtrends. Follow Tom at Tom Lydon. We just got off to a great start on the Thursday edition of Money Life, and that means there's much more to go, so settle back and relax. I'll be answering a great question from a member of our audience right after this message.
At Hightower, providing the best fiduciary advice to every advisory client is not just a job, it's a legal duty. Sophisticated asset management, lifetime financial planning and wealth management solutions. At Hightower, it all adds up to peace of mind. Visit HightowerAdvisors.com to learn more about the Hightower difference.
Welcome back to Money Life. You know, I like getting your questions, and I've got a great one today that I've been saving for a little while, and today happens to be the day. So we're going to have a talk that really affects almost every one of you, either because you agree with the listener who asked the question, or you own funds that have this particular issue, etc. But first, a quick reminder. If you've got a question for me, don't be shy. Send it to Chuck at MoneyLifeShow.com. I love getting questions. Sometimes they're the impetus for a column. Sometimes they're the impetus for a segment on the radio show. Sometimes both. But I'd love to hear from you. Don't be shy. There is no such thing as a stupid question. I don't answer all of them, but I do try to do what I can. And Dale in London, Ohio, who is one of our regulars, but he's been, I guess, increasingly vocal, offered a quick question recently. He said, Chuck, I tend to always avoid 12b-1 fees like the plague. Is that a good stance to have, or should it be taken in context with the performance of the fund? And by the way, in a separate note, he asked it differently. He said, you know, I am curious, what's your opinion of 12b-1 fees? I try to avoid them. It seems to me that paying a company 0.25% just for distribution and marketing would be a waste of my money. Okay, so here's where we go on 12b-1 fees. 12b-1 fees are named for the segment of the law that allows them to exist. And by the way, it's a sort of a dirty little secret that basically the guy who pretty much created them was Jack Bogle. Yeah. Bogle, of course, is known for creating the index fund. That's his good thing. 12b-1 fees, he didn't really embrace them, but he did kind of see them through a lot of their nascent stages and then said, no, that's not how we want to do it. Now, 12b-1 fees are for sales/distribution and marketing of a fund. And there are plenty of times where they don't make sense, but you need to understand what they're really about. If you own certain types of funds, this is basically a trail commission to your advisor. In other words, if you pay for an advisor who sells you a fund, this is a piece of the money that goes to the advisor, which, by the way, is perfectly appropriate. Even if you think, oh, wait, I paid for an A share to pay my sales charges all up front, this is part of what goes on that allows the advisor to be compensated over time so that they're not coming back trying to push you into something else that you'd be selling and paying commissions on. And if you own C shares of something, right, you're going to pay a higher 12b-1 fee. That's basically about making sure that the advisor gets paid. Now, does all the money go to the advisor? No, it doesn't. And if you didn't use an advisor, can you have a fund with a 12b-1 fee? Yes, you can. 12b-1 fees, here's the interesting side. You can be a no-load mutual fund so that there's no sales charges, but you can still have a small 12b-1 fee. Are they a waste of money? Well, yes and no. Here's what I'd tell you. 12b-1 fees don't have anything to do with the day-to-day performance of the fund. They do have to do with your performance. Why? Because if you add 0.25% to an expense ratio, that comes off the top, right? It's a cost. So if you had a fund that had a 1% expense ratio and then it has a 0.25% 12b-1 fee, you're paying 125 basis points, 1.25, and that comes off the top. If the market makes 10%, you pay 1.25 in expenses, you have 8.75 left. If you didn't pay that 12b1 fee and you had 1% in expenses, you would wind up in a situation where you're getting 9%, and 9% is better than 8.75. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. But if you told me I love the fund, so here's where you get back to Dale's question. He said, I try to avoid 12b1 fees like the plague. To me, I think you look at it differently. I think you go find the funds you want and you find out, are they worth the price you're talking about paying for them? In other words, if you have a great fund, something that you like, that you think, I really like the manager, I've heard a lot about it, I'm paying for active management, and the total expenses on the fund, so the fund's expenses inclusive of the 12b1 fee, are say 0.7%, which is about average. And I say that's about average. That's what's known as the dollar weighted average. Like the average for a stock fund is somewhere around 1.4%, but that includes goofy little tiny funds that nobody invests in. In fact, the Investment Company Institute, the trade association for the fund industry, just came out with something that said, hey, fund expenses have been trending downward over the last 20 years. You can also thank Jack Bogle for that. The Vanguard Group coming out and getting into everybody's head about costs has been a godsend. It's been a great thing. So what happens is, yeah, if you went out and started a fund tomorrow and you've got very little money in it, it's going to cost you probably 2% or more to run that fund. And then you could have the Vanguard Index 500 with its tiny, tiny expense ratio and a gazillion dollars in assets. And your average is still going to be somewhere north of 1%, right? Tiny above 2%. Yep, you're still going to be there. So the average expense ratio is like 1.25 to 1.4 is typically what it gets quoted as for funds, for stock funds. And it's a little bit less than that. It's more like 1 to 1.25 on bond funds. But the dollar weighted average, where people put their money, says that the average expense ratio for stock funds is closer to 0.7%. In other words, people are buying the lowest cost issues, and that's where the money's going. So again, if you had that example that we just used, the gazillion dollars in the Vanguard Index 500 compared to the, you know, couple of bucks in the really expensive fund, well, on average, the dollar weighted average is very small. They're paying almost nothing. When you look at that math, and now you go, okay, I want to pay no more than 1%, or I want to pay no more than 0.75%. I want to make sure that I'm paying no more than average expenses. If that was the way you wanted to do it, and I think it's a good thing. I think when you're looking at funds, you should be saying, what are the characteristics I want? I want this kind of management. I want expenses that are average or better for the peer group or what have you. And again, things will depend. If you're buying an emerging markets fund or something that's esoteric, you may have higher expense ratios. If you're buying microcaps, you might be looking at a higher expense ratio. But if you go in and saying, wait, I want the following things present in my fund and I want low cost to be one of them, then that 0.75 number is there. Now, let's get back to Dale's case. If the total expense ratio, including the 12B1 fee, is below average, then I don't know that you care that you're paying the 12B1 fee. You might prefer that the fund did without it, but chances are it was set up at some point when they were marketing the fund, getting it up to current size, and it's kind of a legacy back to something else. Likewise, if you're dealing with an advisor, well, you want to look at the cost structures of the various share classes. So A shares, A for all at once, up front, and you might have a 12B1 fee, but it's probably going to be a small one. B shares, back end load. You'll have a heightened 12B1 fee for a period of time, and then that will shrink down because B shares sort of start with a back end load, and they kind of say, hey, if you leave the fund, you'll pay us a commission out the door. But they typically have a higher 12B1 fee because you're paying the advisor for their advice, and then they convert to A shares after the back-end load goes away. C shares, I always say they stand for Chuck hates them because they have higher costs for life. You're not paying a front-end load. You're not paying a back-end load, but you are paying typically the way they've, it's the same expense ratio. It's just that they have a bigger 12B1 fee, and you're going to pay that for life. I don't like that structure because over time, it becomes the most costly. But I think that's what you're really looking at. Do I hate 12B1 fees? I don't love them, that's for sure. But to me, the question is, what are you paying for the fund, and is the fund worth it? Not what's the fee structure. Just lump 12B1, which it is, in with the expense ratio. Make sure you factor it in there. Make sure you're looking at the total expense ratio of the fund, inclusive of 12B1s. If the expense ratio is competitive and you like the fund, then I'm not sure whether you like the 12B1 fee or not. I'm not sure you care. Think about it this way. For some of you who are in 12B1s and wondering about it, you might be looking at the 12B1 fee. That's what's going to help the fund company make the fund available on the platform that you want to be buying the fund on. You're in some fund supermarket and you've got this tiny little fund. That's called paying for shelf space. It may not be anybody's favorite practice, but it's why you can go to the Schwab network or the Fidelity network and go, oh, I can buy this tiny little fund here. So do I like 12B1 fees? No. Do I avoid them if I can? Sure. But as a general rule, I wouldn't look at them and worry. I look at total expense ratio and make sure that a fund is charging me for whatever, a cost that I can live with, that I believe is reasonable for what I expect on the performance. Do that, and you won't be eliminating anybody whose fund might be great, but whose cost structure is just kind of set up in this goofy, archaic way. That's my take on 12B1 fees. If you want to know my take on something else, ask me a question. Chuck@moneylifeshow.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, Dale, for the question. Up next, Bob Powell. We'll be talking about the Employee Benefit Research Institute Confidence Survey for 2016 when Money Life continues in just a moment.
Customize an investment portfolio with FlexShares, ETFs designed to pursue targeted goals and to adapt to changing market conditions with both equity and fixed income solutions. For more information, go to FlexShares.com.
Your retirement years are coming. Are you financially ready for your retirement?
You know, I've been thinking.
Oh, that would explain the beads of sweat.
Don't let this happen to you.
I'm afraid it's just not sufficient to refinance your home.
Where shall I go? What shall I do?
My advice to you, start drinking heavily.
Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I think something is happening.
Bob Powell knows where to turn and how to help you with your financial needs as you plan for or live in retirement.
Here I come to save the day.
It's all here as Retirement Weekly's Bob Powell joins Money Life every week for Senior Focus.
Senior citizens, although slow and dangerous behind the wheel, can still serve a purpose.
Bob Powell joins us now for Senior Focus. This is the segment where we take a look at things that, whether you are a senior or you're just planning to be one, you're going to want to know things that are going on that are going to affect your retirement savings, your retirement earnings, and most importantly, your retirement happiness. And Bob Powell's in a great place to judge that stuff because he's the editor of Retirement Weekly. He's also a columnist with MarketWatch. His work appears in the Retire Mentors section. So if you go to MarketWatch.com, you can go to Retire Mentors and find Bob there. And from there, you'll find links to Retirement Weekly, his newsletter, which is also a MarketWatch product. You can follow Bob on Twitter. He's @RJPIII. But right now, he's here. Bob Powell, welcome back to the show.
Chuck, thanks for having me on.
This week, we are talking about the Employee Benefits Research Institute's 2016 Retirement Confidence Survey. And there's good news. Like, normally we get a study like this and we go, it's more bad news. People can't retire. You know, nobody's got anything saved. But actually, retiree confidence was increasing.
Yeah. So there's some good news and some bad news and some realistic news. Let me go down the bad news first, and then we can go back to the good news. The first thing that I noticed, and I think is interesting, I was talking to Jack Vanderhey, who is the co-author of the report, and he said there's a big gap between the amount of money people are saving for retirement and then the amount that they should be saving. Roughly 38% think they need to save less than 20%, 17% say they need to save between 20 and 29%, and 22% think they need to save 30% or more, and then another 22% said they don't even know how much they should be saving. And when you ask them, that's how much you think you should be saving, how much are you saving, what you find is a big, big gap. And what they say is that they're going to make up the gap by doing a couple things, which Jack describes as a gamble. What they say they're going to do is save more later, live on less later, work into retirement, or retire later. And Jack says that's a gamble. It's unrealistic to think that given the other results in the survey, which is half of the people who say they want to keep working into retirement are able to do so. Less than half, 46% of current retirees retired unexpectedly. So this notion of saying that you're going to save more later or work into retirement or retire later are pretty much non-starters for all those people who say that they're going to, you know, save more tomorrow, save more later. It's just not going to happen. Or it might happen for half of them, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think my best advice would be, given that, is don't procrastinate around this stuff. Now, the one thing that Jack did say is because this number is lumped in with young and old people, it's quite possible that if you're young and you're paying off your college loans and whatnot, that you will be able to save more later.
Yeah, save more later for those people is what they're doing in their 40s and 50s.
Yeah, in your late 40s, 50s, certainly in your 60s, and you're saying that you're going to save more later or retire later, that's a bad plan. You should just say, I'm going to save more today, and that will go a long way. Speaking of which, the other good news is, in terms of save more today, that the folks who do have a retirement plan, and I don't mean like you have a written plan, I mean you have an account, you have an IRA, a 401k, a defined benefit, the odds are much better of you being able to be confident about the retirement that you'll have versus those folks. And this may sound obvious, right? You have a retirement account, you're more confident that you'll be able to retire comfortably in retirement versus those who don't have a retirement account. So I think that the takeaway there is, if you don't have a retirement account, open up an IRA. If you don't have a 401k at work, open up an IRA. If you have a 401k at work and you're not participating, join it right away. And all that will be one, you know, ways to boost your retirement confidence. The other thing is, there's a correlation between having an advisor and retirement confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you don't have an advisor, you know, go find one, even if it's only to get, you know, a second opinion, right, about what you're doing. You don't have to hire someone for life, but have someone give your plan a look-see and see if you're on track or not. That will improve your retirement confidence. Now, I did have an interesting discussion with Jack about this, Chuck, and I think you'll enjoy it, right, which is there any correlation between having confidence and actually having adequate retirement income? Are people foolhardy, you know, to think that they're confident about their retirement, but when they get there, they just don't even have enough income to retire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about this, and the thought is, yes, there's a big link between being confident, having assets, and having adequacy. And that led me to a public policy question with Jack, which was, knowing what we know about having a retirement plan, be it an IRA or 401k, and knowing how it improves confidence, and knowing that we have a coverage problem in the U.S., wouldn't it make sense to do what they've done in the U.K., which is to mandate access to a retirement plan in the workplace? And he wouldn't address that specifically. They're nonpartisan. But what he did say was that they have run numbers to show that if every American, man, woman, and child in the workplace was offered a retirement plan, that the gap, the shortfall between what we have in terms of adequacy and what we need would be reduced by 20%, which is pretty good news.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't eliminate it completely, but mandating access to a retirement plan could go a long way toward solving some of the retirement crises that we have.
Unfortunately, what most folks consider the mandated retirement plan in this country right now would be Social Security.
Yeah, it's true. And I'm going to write more about this, but in essence, Social Security is a national defined benefit plan. And given that, you know, employer-sponsored defined benefit plans have gone the way of the dodo bird, maybe it is time to think about a national defined contribution plan that, where at least people are offered coverage.
Right. The way you can buy into healthcare, you should be able to have some way that you can save in a 401k or something along those lines. It makes great sense.
Yeah, Jack was worried that, you know, we're going down this path of having state-sponsored retirement plans, and each of these states is going to have a different flavor, and there's, you know, going to be lots of confusion between the Illinois plan and the California plan and the Oregon plan. I thought that wouldn't it be better just to have one national plan that everyone can feed into, much like they're doing in the UK with the Nest program. And, you know, I'm going to be writing a column about this in the next couple of weeks, this notion of that, you know, the UK seems like they're so far ahead of the US in terms of improving retirement security in their country that, you know, we should take a page from them.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Meanwhile, the EBRI research, well, it catches the eyes of you and me and everybody who writes about this stuff, and folks want to learn more about it, they can go to EBRI, EBRI.org. But if they want to learn more about it, they can also check out your column and your work in the Retirementor section at MarketWatch and in Retirement Weekly. Bob, thanks as always for joining us.
Chuck, thanks for having me on the show.
Bob Powell, editor of Retirement Weekly. Follow him on Twitter. He's at RJPIII. Up next, the Money Life Market Call. Roger Conrad will be in the house when Money Life continues right after this message.
Independent and advisor-owned, Hightower ensures that best-in-class financial product and service providers compete for your business every day. A groundbreaking model that's making waves on Wall Street. Discover what Hightower can do for you at HightowerAdvisors.com.
It's hard to know what to do next in the stock market.
Where am I? What am I doing here?
That's because one expert's rally is another's prelude to a correction.
Of course, people do go both ways.
One manager's buy is another man's sell.
Have you come to any conclusions yet?
Each day, the Money Life Market Call brings you a different expert's take on where to invest and what to avoid.
Now listen, Grapehead, I'll explain it so even you can understand it.
Just as important, you'll find out the reasons behind that thinking, and that should make your next financial decisions easier and smarter.
We do have a system, and it works.
It's the Money Life Market Call. Now.
The only reason we're here is to make catty observations and rude remarks. And there was nothing good on TV.
Welcome to the Money Life Market Call, where my guest today is Roger Conrad, editor of Conrad's Utility Investor Newsletter. That, among other things, makes him a partner with Elliott Gew, because the company that publishes Conrad's Utility Investor is Capitalist Times, Elliott Gew from the Energy and Income Advisor, and between Elliott and Roger, two of your absolute favorites, because they talk about energy stocks, they talk about income opportunities and more, and I get a ton of requests to have them on the show. Now, if you've never heard Roger before, or if you've heard him and liked him, but you've never been to the website, it's conradsutilityinvestor.com, just like it sounds, no apostrophe, conradsutilityinvestor.com. Roger is on Twitter. He's at Roger_Conrad. Right now, he's back with us. Roger, welcome back to Money Life.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I talked about the fact that we do get a bunch of emails, people always wanting you and Elliott on the show, but I want to make sure that everybody who wants you back and anybody who's new understands the methodology. So you are looking at utility stocks, but there's certain things that have to be there for you to actually be interested. Let us know how it works.
Well, that's absolutely right. I tend to look at things kind of from a longer-term perspective than a lot of other people do. Utilities focus does give you that opportunity because a lot of the what happens is determined over a period of years. So things like regulation, investment plans, rates of return, you know, these are all very important factors, but they don't tend to show up one way or another in the price of the stock over a week period or a month period. They tend to show up over a year period, a couple year period. So I've used these as vehicles in my own portfolio for savings over long periods of time, reinvesting dividends. They've been pretty effective for me. I think there's a tremendous number of opportunities, you know, in that space right now. And if you look at just the electric area, the fact that companies are upgrading their grids, that they're looking into renewable energy in a big way, they're converting from coal-fired power to natural gas. All these are huge investments, and in the right regulatory environment, the shareholders will share in the benefit with a rising dividend and a rising stock price. So I tend to look at things, again, kind of longer term. I look at the underlying business very carefully. I'm actually looking at a lot of the volatility factors in today's market, because I do think that we can tweak our long-term strategy and do well by making a few tactical moves, taking profits in some stocks, buying some things when they're cheaper, when the market moves against them. So a lot of different things go into the strategy, but again, it's primarily long-term, very focused on dividends.
What makes you sell? I mean, obviously you just talked a little bit about being opportunistic, but what else makes you say it's time to go?
You know, there are two basic things. One would be if a company's underlying business is starting to come apart. You know, that doesn't happen all that often in the utility space. It does happen in another group that we're talking about that we spent a lot of time researching. That is energy, and particularly energy midstream pipeline companies and so forth. A huge shakeout underway there as companies that are involved with better counterparties are doing business in better projects, better financing. Other companies, though, are going to have a lot of trouble. And, you know, we don't think that oil prices are going to get much above $60 over the next several years. A lot of the companies out there are raised on $100 oil. So we're very concerned with getting people out of those types of companies and into the companies that can do better in a lower for longer environment. So that's one way to sell. The other condition that I'll sell under is if a company has simply outrun its prospects. And we're actually seeing that in a number of utilities nowadays with some of the companies that have received merger offers, some companies that have just gone up because other companies in their space have received lucrative takeover offers. A number of things that trigger momentum into these stocks, and that to me is a good time to take a little money off the table, particularly in the eighth year of a bull market that's showing some signs of being quite long in the tooth and where breadth is deteriorated, for example, to a large extent. And again, you just want to take some money off the table in some of these situations. You'll have more money when there are better bargains to be had.
Does that mean that right now you're not fully invested?
I think it's a good time to hold some cash, you know, and that being not fully invested means a lot of things to a lot of different things to different people. But yeah, I think it's a good idea to hold some cash. And in fact, you know, taking some money off the table in some of the better names, but also taking advantage of the recent push up in oil prices to get out of some of the riskier names in energy. That's another thing that we're doing. And again, it raises cash, and we think we're going to have a much better opportunity somewhere down the road, you know, maybe possibly by the end of the year, for buying a lot of different stocks. Energy is probably closer to a bottom, or it's certainly much closer to a bottom than some of the leaders in the current market. But again, I think this is a good time to again build up some dry powder for better opportunities ahead.
That being the case, are those opportunities going to be in the classic utility companies, the power generation companies? They're going to be in something like water companies.
I think the utilities are really a space where people need to differentiate. I know that's not a typically held belief. Conventional wisdom is they all move together, and particularly when the Fed does something or interest rates go up and down. But there's a huge differentiation right now. You have companies like NextEra Energy, Dominion Resources, that have increased their earnings growth to high single-digit rates. And you have a number of other companies that are only growing at a low single-digit rate. So if you just compare them in one swoop in terms of valuations, you'll miss that nuance. So whereas companies like, you know, Dominion and NextEra, you know, they've made that jump. They're investing in these areas that I mentioned a minute ago, that are very high percentage in terms of translating that into earnings and dividend growth. You know, those are the good ones to buy. Some of the others that are growing more slowly that you just see momentum kind of sloshing into, those are, I think, in many cases, sells, and or at least a good profit-taking opportunities.
Okay, let's talk about a name or two right now that passes the screen that's the kind of thing that you think can stand up, given what's been going on in the economy and a time when you want to keep some powder dry.
Well, you know, I really like Dominion Resources. I know I've mentioned it on the show. It's a little bit more expensive than it was at previous times I've been on the show, but it's still below my buy target, which is 75. What do I like about this? Well, you know, like I say, they've made that jump from a low single digit growth rate to a high single digit growth rate, and aren't really getting the full credit, I think, in the share price for that. And again, their opportunities are heavy in natural gas, particularly bringing gas to utilities that are switching to natural gas generation from coal. But also in things like solar power, things like you know, grid investment that go right under their utility rate base. And in Virginia, they really have, I think, probably the most favorable regulatory environment in the country, with a rate of return locked in over the next 6 years, and then a long-term investing plan over that time where their expenditures are actually pre-approved. So That I don't, you know, for me, people that have owned utilities a long time, that's been a big risk with investment that the regulators, you know, pull a bait and switch after the investment's made. And, you know, in Virginia, that's not going to happen. So again, a very, strong, case for continued, very steady, and in fact, pretty robust growth in earnings and dividends going forward that's not fully reflected in the share price.
Okay, so that's ticker symbol D, Dominion Resources. What else stands out to you right now?
Well, you know, I mentioned NextEra Energy, but that one I think is maybe a little bit more expensive now than I'd like to pay. I'd like to see that one come back more, you know, probably, well, at least around back to around 100 before buying. But the third company in that group of companies that is investing in, again, all these growth areas and has a strong balance sheet to do it is Sempra Energy. SRE is the symbol, and that one is based in the primary unit is in Southern California, San Diego Gas and Electric, but they're also, again, a heavy investor in gas infrastructure, a big presence in Mexico. There's a lot of U.S. gas going to Mexico, and that's one of the growth areas in that business. They're also pretty big in the renewable energy side of things. And one of the advantages that Sempra and Dominion and NextEra have over their competitors in the midstream gas pipeline space, but also the renewable energy solar space, is a much lower cost of capital. Utilities have performed well. Again, these companies, by increasing their growth rates, are earning higher valuations, and their cost of debt capital is very low as well. That's the opposite situation than what we're seeing in much of the solar power industry, for example, and also in the energy midstream pipeline business. So while their competitors are actually struggling, they're able to make whatever investments they want, and again, with a very, very low cost of capital to fund them.
What's something that you've had to move away from as you've gotten more choosy and you've gotten to where you want to keep some powder dry? What's a case where you've sort of said, you know, I'd rather step away from this one?
Well, you know, primarily in the, and this may surprise some people, but primarily in the natural gas distribution space. Now, we've seen a number of very lucrative deals take place. We were lucky enough to have one, Piedmont Energy, or Piedmont Natural Gas, which was taken over by Duke Energy, and they received a premium of about 60% on the pre-deal trading range. So a pretty outstanding return for holding what was a very strong company. But what we saw happening after that was speculation that all these other natural gas utilities would be taken over. So some of them have, but we are seeing, again, valuations really bump up to those prices. And, you know, not all these deals are sure bets. I mean, one thing about utilities that are taken over, they have to get regulators to go along with those deals. And in some cases, it takes months and even years to get the approvals. And in some cases, they just don't occur at all. So what I've been advising people to do is, you know, when you get a company and it does get a takeover offer and it does go up to that close to that takeover price, take that money off the table. Make the sale before that deal goes through. That way you eliminate the risk that the deal doesn't go through. And again, if we see failing deals in an environment where stock prices are starting to come down, you're really going to lose that gain that you've just received. So again, it sort of goes back to, you know, even though you might get to a point where there'll be a little bit more gain you can eke out by holding on, you want to be safe than sorry. You want to take the bird in the hand versus the two in the bush when you see some of these deals taking place. So, you know, again, that's an opportunistic way to take some money off the table, build a little cash pile for a better opportunity down the road.
Well, now we're going to find out whether my audience is building opportunities as we take a look at some stocks that they're particularly interested in.
Play, hold it.
You got to know when to hold up.
Or fold it.
Know when to fold up.
It's Hold It or Fold It time with Roger Conrad, editor of Conrad's Utility Investor. ConradsUtilityInvestor.com. He's on Twitter at Roger_Conrad. If you want to learn more about the firm, including sister newsletters, go to CapitalistTimes.com on Twitter at CapitalistTimes. Hold It or Fold It, you know how it works. So we're just going to jump right in, and we're going to start with two requests we got from Joe in Colorado Springs. The first is for Buckeye Partners Limited Partnership, BPL.
Well, you want to hold that one. It's in fact, it's a buy if you don't own it. Great company with a lot of what you call exposure in the pipeline business on the downstream side. So they're shipping fuel to end users, airports, and so forth, where low prices have actually stimulated demand. They're doing quite well. Their stock price has been caught up with some of the other midstream master limited partnerships, but yielding 7%, growing that dividend around 5% a year, this is a really good one. So you want to hold this one.
Realistically, it's a buy.
Yeah, it's a buy.
On Buckeye Partners, ticker symbol BPL. Joe also wanted to know about TransCanada Corp, TRP.
Interesting one. They just did a takeover of a company called Columbia Pipeline Group. This is going to give them a presence in natural gas coming out of the Marcellus Shale parts of Appalachia where they don't have a presence at this point. They're talking about accelerating their dividend growth rate, which is already growing about 8 to 10% a year. The stock's been beaten down to some extent because the Canadian dollar's been weak, but I think this is a good place to buy it. And if you own it, you want to continue to hold it.
Buying, holding if you got it, but buying more on TransCanada Corp, TRP. Our next request, last time you were on the show, you talked about it. You hinted at it as a hold, but that was, I think, the sister company. You were talking about NextEra Energy. That's NEE. Brian in Houston wants to know about NextEra Energy Partners, NEP. And like I said, last time you were on the show, you actually made this stock a buy. Still worth buying?
I think it's still a buy. You know, it's one of those rare companies in the renewable energy, midstream energy space that has not crashed and burned over the last several months. And the reason is because it has a very strong sponsor in NextEra Energy. But this company, I think, is going to really benefit going forward from growth of renewable energy in the U.S., particularly big utility scale plants, which are much more efficient than most distributed energy right now. And they're also the recipient of drop downs from the parent, which means that the parent, NextEra Energy, basically sells them power plants, contracted energy under very favorable terms. So you really have a locked in formula for dividend growth of 15 to 20% a year off a yield of about a little less than 5%. I think it's a great deal. And again, in an area with that, I think has a lot of legs going forward.
NextEra Energy, NEE, that was a hold. But NextEra Energy Partners, NEP, that's a buy.
Yeah, that's the way to play that group, I think.
Next, for Dale in London, Ohio, a little switch here because I made sure that you saw our list of closed-end funds because, well, you're an income investor and a lot of folks use closed-end funds. You picked one off of that list. It's Reeves Utility Income. That's UTG.
You know, I'm a big fan of buying individual stocks. I think we can do better than funds and ETFs. But this is a closed-end fund that has a very good record, a reasonable expense ratio, a pretty good dividend that has been fairly conservatively managed and also increased on a regular basis. And you don't get the current portfolio of what these guys have from the publicly released information, but you can get an idea of what the kind of stocks they hold. And as of the last published portfolio, I like what it holds. And it's an added bonus. Closed-end funds, you know, they don't trade right at their asset value as open-end funds do. They tend to trade a little above or a little below. And in this case, you've got a fund that's trading actually a little below the value of its underlying assets. So again, with the caveat that I think investors can do better picking their own, I think if you want to own a fund that owns utilities, this would be my pick.
That's a buy on UTG, the Reeves Utility Income Closed-End Fund. And last, for James in Burlington, Vermont, it's Hawaiian Electric Industries, HE.
Well, this would be a sell. I think, again, I mentioned that when a company gets a merger deal and the share price pretty much moves to that level or close to that level or that takeover price, then you want to take the money off the table. Don't take a risk on the regulators approving or disapproving the deal. In this case, this is actually a company that the acquiring company is actually NextEra Energy, which I do like a lot. And if this deal did go through, shareholders would be getting some shares of NextEra Energy in addition to a couple of other things as well. But this is kind of a murky situation out there, and I don't have an extreme amount of confidence that they're going to approve this deal. There's a lot of local politics involved. I've been following the situation very closely, but with HE now at about $32 a share, pretty close to what it could be worth in a takeover, I think it's a good idea to take the money off the table. So that would be fold it, I guess. And again, use the cash, building your cash pile for better times ahead.
Take the money and run on Hawaiian Electric Industries, HE. And unfortunately, we have to run. We're out of time. Roger, it's great chatting with you always. Look forward to doing it again soon.
Thanks.
Roger Conrad is the editor at Conrad's Utility Investor. Conrad'sUtilityInvestor.com. He's on Twitter at Roger_Conrad. We'll come back to wrap up today's edition of Money Life in just a moment.
PowerShares provides a different take on traditional asset categories while providing advisors and investors with innovative investment opportunities. For more information, go to PowerShares.com. Invesco Distributors Incorporated.
Great getting a chance to chat with Roger Conrad. I want to go over something and make sure that it is clear what he said and how I interpreted it. So during the early part of the interview, when I was asking him for things that he liked, he talked about Next Era Energy, but he said he doesn't like it as a buy right now. He would hold it, but he didn't feel it was strong enough to continue to buy it right now. Then we got to hold it or fold it, and we were talking about Next Era Energy Partners. Similar name, related business, but the limited partnership that trades under NEP instead of NEE. That is the security that was on the last time he was on the show. So the last time Tom and I had talked about it, he talked about NEP during the portion, I think, where we were saying, hey, what do you like, etc. Now he came back. He was a request and hold it or fold it for Brian in Houston. And he came back and he still likes it. That's the buy. So he talked about Dominion. He talked about Spectrum. D and SRE were the buys early in today. NEE was not a buy. It was a hold. And then NEP was the buy. That's the stock that was also the buy last time. Wanted to make that clear. Hey, tomorrow on this show, Christian Greiner from the Azad Ethical Fund will be here. That's going to be fun. We have added a number of your favorites to the upcoming guest calendar. How about Chuck Carlson from the Drip Investor, Sandy Villery from the Villery Balanced and Villery Equity Funds, Bill Mann from the Motley Fool Funds, Bernie Horn and Josh Peters, Bernie Horn from Polaris Global, Josh Peters from Morningstar. They were already in the calendar, on the calendar. So we're working hard to get some guests lined up. There'll be a lot of news coming. Meanwhile, I want to thank my guests from today. So, of course, Tom Lydon and Bob Powell, our regulars. Roger Conrad, always great to chat with him. I want to thank Rob Floyd, my producer. And I want to thank you because I really appreciate you being here. All right, today's Money Life quote of the day comes from Will Smith. Yeah, you know, that Will Smith, getting jiggy with it. Will Smith, Jada Pinkett and Will Smith, however you want to figure it out. Yeah, that Will Smith, who said, I'm very serious with my kids about them comprehending the intricacies of global finance. Well, that means he's taken his kids to maybe a level that I didn't take mine to, and I thought I was pretty good. But I do think that everybody needs to know at least the intricacies of personal finance. Global finance, that's an extra step. But personal finance, yep, everybody needs to know it. And one of the things that they need to know is that, hey, until we do this again the next time, the best thing you could do for your money is to not worry too much about it. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
This show is an informational service only. The information provided herein is not to be construed as an offer to buy or sell securities of any kind, and not to be considered a recommendation to buy any stock, but an information resource to aid the investor in making an informed decision. All listeners should consult a qualified professional before trading in any security or pursuing any financial or tax strategy. The information provided has been obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable, but is not guaranteed as to its accuracy or completeness. Hey!